Well, guys, why don't we go ahead and get started so we can make sure everyone can stay on the call for as long as possible. I'm just gonna do the quick committee roster roll call and say a few words, and then I'm gonna turn it over to Kevin and Jim at TAC to lead the discussion. So for the committee, I'm going to start with the roster. Becky Dempsey?
Present.
David Dannenfelter?
Present.
Gene Langendorf? Kenneth Darden? Mike Goodwin?
Here from afar.
And Tim Urban?
Present.
All righty. So we have, we do have four out of the six. That's great. And then the others in the room, and on the call, we'll introduce as well. I'll start with here in the room. I'm Ashley Schweikart, coordinator of the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council.
Elizabeth Yevich, director of the Housing Resource Center.
And Cameron Dorsey, director of multifamily finance with TDHCA.
And then, Jim and Kevin, you want to introduce yourselves?
Sure. Jim Yates, senior associate from TAC.
Hi, Kevin Martone, executive director with TAC.
Great, great. Thank you, everyone. Is there anyone else from the public that's on the call? All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining today for this housing committee discussion. As I mentioned in my email, the purpose of this discussion is to have an open dialogue about the findings that were presented by TAC in their draft state best practices report, looking at what other states are doing to create and develop and fund service-enriched housing. And also, we want to make sure that we move this process forward to the next stage, which is creating the comprehensive analysis of service-enriched housing finance practices report, which is the, I guess, bigger final report that includes recommendations. And so in order to facilitate the creation of an outline and create those recommendations, TAC wanted to speak with the council again, and we thought that splitting up into the two committees that the council has already had established made the most sense, so we could talk about the housing. And then tomorrow, there's gonna be another call for the services committee. So with that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Jim and Kevin.
Great. This is Jim, and I'm gonna be kind of going through the housing. And I did, through Ashley, I sent out a housing kind of an outline for the discussion. And we asked Ashley and TDHCA to kind of bring together the housing committee to really kind of segue from the best practice report to kind of our work on the analysis piece and developing the recommendations for the second stage of the report. And we wanted to create some mechanisms and dialogue to really kind of call out what were some of the aspects of the different state models, understanding that it's a very comprehensive report, a lot of detailed information, a lot of interesting strategies and tidbits that we wanted to try to make sure that we conveyed a lot of richness within that report, but really wanted to try to hear feedback from you on what different aspects of the different state models seem to have some interest and some traction or made some sense from kind of where Texas is now from your perspective, as well as kind of, so it might be a little bit of Pennsylvania mixed in with some New Mexico and also what Texas is kind of moving on and working on now. And also, before we start, I did want to formally congratulate the state and that just this past week, probably everyone knows that the state of Texas and TDHCA were awarded a Section 811 project-based demonstration grant. Highly competitive process, I believe one of 12 or 13 states approved nationally out of 35, 36 applicants. So congratulations to the state, and you know, start rolling up your sleeves and getting to work. I know a lot of work was done from the state partners' perspective this past summer on the application that really did show. And this also does create an opportunity as we go along in this discussion about how in the short term, being the next 2 or 3 years, how these Section 811 resources can be leveraged and almost create, you know, how can that be the state platform for a larger effort moving forward and as a jumping off point. So that's our introduction. And I did want to also offer, recognizing that we have state agencies and local partners, governor appointees as part of the council. We want to have an open dialogue as much as possible, but understanding within a group, if folks do feel like they want to convey some of their thoughts on the report or kind of where they think things should go on a individual basis, please feel open to reach out to myself and we can schedule a call as well. So I did want to place that out. We do want to get as much kind of feedback from folks and don't want to necessarily just leave this as the only forum if need be. So the first kind of area of focus we wanted to talk about was housing and financing strategies. We want to spend a little bit of a good 20 to 30 minutes of time on that piece and really looking at what different state models, and I don't want to go into any detail or any, I don't want to talk about the state models, but the kind of the first area was generally folks' thoughts about the different states on how they either incentivized or required service-enriched housing or permanent supportive housing within their multifamily development and what different state models had you know, were attractive, you know, from your perspective. And I'm just going to open that up for anyone.
So for those following along in the outline, that's the discussion point 2A.
And when I talk about incentives, it really kind of focused in on through the low-income housing tax credit program, providing incentives, point incentives within their qualified allocation plan to encourage developers to incorporate service-enriched housing or supportive housing within their applications. Different states did differently, different tiered approaches, different level of points. Every QAP is a little bit different depending on the state's housing policies and priorities. The point kind of incentive was used by at least three or four states to encourage development.
This is Mike Goodwin from afar. I think that two things that kind of struck me, and I'll use Illinois and New Mexico, or at least, you know, your report of the activities in New Mexico and Illinois, and that is what I will call the top-end coordination and push that came from, I'll say, very senior people in the state governments that made the decision that this was going to happen, and the appearance that they were in fact directly involved. And I am the governor's appointee from development, and you know, you can do all the stuff you want in the QAP, the writing of it and the points, but when you get the senior level people across the board like they apparently did, it makes a much stronger impact for you to look to figure out how to do those than if they just appear in the QAP, because quite honestly, as a normal developer, you're going to try to look the easier things to do, like putting 100 books in the library, as opposed to taking additional units for persons with disabilities or increasing the number or percentage that you're going to use. So, you know, you're looking for the easier points. Now, in the state of Texas, I haven't done tax credits here for a long time, but I've watched them. In the past, there has been no issue with having enough applications to absorb all the tax credits that were available to be awarded. So, you know, you'll pick them up. But like I said, the thing that impressed me was the push from the senior government level in both states to say, folks, this is going to happen. We're going to make it happen. Here's how it's going to do. And that got disseminated into every facet of the communities that serve this population, whether it be services, housing, facilities, education, whatever.
This is Tim Irvin commenting. You know, when you look at the QAP, our tax credit allocation is already cut up into so many pieces, both through our regional and sub-regional allocations, also through our nonprofit and at-risk and USDA set-asides. If you were going to go the requirement-based method, I mean, really, I guess what you're talking about was whether the legislature would weigh in with the creation of some additional set-aside or something. If you're looking at incentives, again, the QAP is already being pushed and pulled many, many different directions. Right now, the biggest direction probably being by the federal court, which has directed us to achieve greater geographic diversity in the dispersion of our credits. I mean, they've basically put us under a court order to put more credits in, frankly, wealthier neighborhoods. And, you know, all of the cost issues and so forth that go along with those kinds of things make it quite challenging to meet the court's requirements and provide enough there a meaningful opportunity for supportive housing to be competitive. And by the way, I'm not just talking about putting elderly deals in wealthier neighborhoods. I'm talking about putting general use deals in family deals in neighborhoods.
This is James Hill in Fort Worth. I'm the governor's appointee for banking, and I just, without getting into too much detail on financing and tax credits, you know, the incentive-based model is much easier from a banking perspective to get a deal for a guy like Mark financed. So I wanted to throw that little piece in there.
Thanks, James.
Well, this is David with Texas State Affordable. One question I'd have back for TDHCA staff is, do you believe there's even room within the current legislative requirements under the QAP to add points for service-enriched housing, or is that something that you really don't have enough wiggle room within statute to do?
I believe under 6725, we've got authority to create below-the-line, bring items for all kinds of different things that would effectuate board policy.
Tim, it's Kevin. So, I mean, this is an unfair question, and don't chuckle. I mean, if money wasn't an objective, so understanding your geographic push and having to maybe go into more expensive neighborhoods, which complicates projects and everything like that, if money were less of an object, if you know, maybe later on we tackle other, you know, deep subsidy and things like that, would there be a preference on incentive versus requirement-based approach?
I always like incentives.
Yeah, I would agree. This is Cameron. I would agree with him. I'm partial to incentives, but incentives can often function like threshold criteria. And anytime we create scoring incentives that have, you know, more than one or two points associated with them, they effectively function as threshold criteria. If a developer doesn't elect them, there's almost no chance of getting financed, and therefore it doesn't function really like an incentive should.
You almost need to lay the incentives out so that they function like a menu. For example, you can take the approach that I'm going to put my deal in a very high opportunity, high income neighborhood, or you can take the approach that I'm going to go after the points that come with meaningful community revitalization in a higher poverty neighborhood, and it becomes, you know, a tactical decision, which one do you want to pursue? And it seems to me that as long as they're on more or less an equal footing, then those kinds of incentive choices work. But when they get disproportionate, then everybody goes wherever it's going to win.
And I'd like to just welcome Jean Langendorf, just walked in the door, so she's joining us now as well.
Kim, Cameron, we saw that in a number of states. This is Jim, where, for example, New Mexico, the structure of the incentives, you know, resulted in a fairly, you know, high in the 80s to 90s in terms of folks taking the points. In other areas where the points may have been a little lower, or, you know, in comparison to the overall structure of the QAP, you had a more of a 35% to 40% acceptance. You know, there's good and bad about that, from our point of view. I think the key piece is if you get a pretty significant buy-in, then from the service coordination, the waiting list, and their kind of the systems kind of to deliver the people, to deliver referrals and to ensure service coordination, that system really needs to be in place to perform in order to be responsive and make the programs and to be seen as successful from a developer's and housing perspective. If they don't perform in an adequate manner, then you're going to get a lot of pushback from the development community. So depending on kind of how the incentives are structured, really having the infrastructure from the waiting list referral and service coordination piece to kind of back it up and to kind of is just as important to have that lined up with your incentive package in terms of what you think that's going to create, if that makes sense.
Anyone else want to weigh in on the 2A incentive versus requirement-based policies?
I'll just say one more thing. I mean, in my experience, you know, it's always difficult, whether it's incentive or requirement-based, if it functions more like a requirement, even if it's categorized as an incentive, you always have, you know, problems when folks that don't really want to provide this type of housing or don't really want to do what the scoring requires them to do, if they feel the need to elect it in order to get finance, in order to effectuate their, you know, business model and create a pipeline for themselves, I think, you know, we've got to be pretty careful about how we structure these. It's never good to have an owner that doesn't want to be providing the type of housing that we're incentivizing. So, you know, I think it's always best. I think generally folks would agree that when folks want and are invested in the provision of these services or partnerships to provide these services, you always have a much better outcome than when you create an incentive that or a requirement where people feel like they don't really have a choice, so they have to do it, despite the fact that it's not really part of their core business model or what have you.
Yeah, we heard that in Illinois, you know, where they were sort of having to grapple with that issue to some degree. And I think they provided a lot of education, really trying to work with potential applicants on that issue. Is that correct, Jim?
Yeah, and I think different states, I mean, I think one of the, from a North Carolina perspective, which is the probably the state with the longest experience with this integrated model in terms of length of time and experience of kind of working with development community. They also have a, they're also primarily the majority of the low-income housing tax credit developers are private developers that don't have a mission-driven focus. So from the beginning, they necessarily weren't, you know, from a mission focus, weren't attracted to supportive housing in general, you know, as kind of wanting to do it, as Cameron talked about. And then some of the ways the state really looked at developing or designing that approach to kind of fit, you know, who they're, the developers that they're working with, is making a pretty simple model and really focusing in on the competencies that multifamily private developers do well. They create good quality housing, period, and making the what they're expected to do in terms of the provision of supportive housing is really opening, making the unit available to a specific target population for a very reasonable amount of time, 30 days of turnover, and 60 days at initial lease up. And if you keep it simple, and you really put the onus and expectation and on the service providers and the state service agencies and the local service providers, and they're really the responsible entities for A, making the referral, B, providing the services necessary to keep the person stably housed, then you're really kind of making sure, you know, the housing folks do what they're really strong at doing, and the service folks do what they're strong at doing. And it seemed to work pretty well in North Carolina in terms of over time acceptance of that model.
And this is Jean, and I think my conversations, and we had North Carolina here about 3 or 4 years ago talking about their program, and when we visited them, I think the beauty of that program and the thing I think it would sell in Texas is the majority of the client involvement or the resident involvement falls on the service providers. And the housers can do their housing, and the service providers find, identify, and I think that would be attractive to developers overall.
And if they don't have a referral, they fill the unit out of their waiting list.
Correct.
If at the end of the day, you know, if the service folks don't, you know, deliver, then they fill the unit with a regular tax credit client, and the building and the function of the project maintains viable. So if it kind of stays, you know, at a kind of reasonable expectation or reasonable request, really, it's on the service provider network to deliver.
Well, these are units that have rental assistance associated with them when the person moves in. Is that right?
From the North Carolina model, that's correct. There's a rental assistance state funded mechanism to write down the rent from either 60% or 50% of AMI to a person's income.
Yeah, and I think that's a linchpin of that model, and is very key to the acceptance from the development community. Otherwise, they want to income qualify folks and ensure that folks have the capacity to make the payments, et cetera, you know, have the credit score. I think the rental assistance is what them a level of comfort in allowing other folks to select the tenants.
And this is Dave again. And what I'd add is that for many years, I remember that developers fought the board, in particular the former chairman of the board, on the issue of having 1, 2, and 3 bedroom units in every single development that was a family-based development. The developers did not like having to do one bedroom units, but Chairman Conine really believed at the time that it was critical, so that there was, you know, because there was a large population, and he still believed that they needed to be able to house single people in. And today, I don't think any developer really complains about the required mix of 1, 2, and 3 bedrooms all that much. They do it out of hand because they've learned how to build that model and they do it successfully. I really think that given time, this same idea can happen with service-enriched housing. I think the developers will figure it out and they'll move forward with it successfully and financially feasibly.
And we saw that in a number of states in terms of there was initial kind of pushback that was kind of working through with folks, and then as deals got done, as folks learned how to do it, as service providers worked with closely with property managers, there was general and kind of overall acceptance of the model, greater acceptance of the model year after year. And from Cameron's point, that's probably a good segue. The next kind of discussion area within the financing strategies is really how do you write down the rent to an affordable level, given that the target populations or focus areas are primarily folks with extremely low incomes at or below, in and around the 20% to 15% AMI level. Different states did it differently. Not everyone did have, as Cameron said, a state-funded rental assistance program to fall back on or that supported the requirement in North Carolina. But other states used a variety of different approaches, and some of them are highlighted under the bullets. But I just wanted to kind of open it up to if there were any different models that seemed a little bit attractive, and it doesn't necessarily have to be one or the other. It could be a menu or a variety to offer as part of that incentive. That
but maybe it's Kevin. Am I correct? There's a bill going through the legislature on funding some sort of rental assistance? Ashley?
You're probably talking about State Health Services.
Okay, so it's going through for them to fund rental assistance?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I heard that it would make sense to me that they get the money and they contract with TDHA to do it, but that's not what's being proposed in the bill. I've heard some discussion of that, but I...
Okay.
And it's an exceptional item.
Uh-huh.
Department of State Health Services.
State Health Services. And an attempt, it's not a bill, really. It's in the exceptional items of the budget.
Okay.
Exceptional items is like everybody's wish list for the most part. But okay. I don't know, because we've been told, I've got to say this year, legislators are like, give me something for people with mental illness.
Yeah.
Don't want to talk guns.
Right.
Now we're going to talk people with mental illness. They've been real upfront about that because everybody's the topic from Connecticut. So it's like, okay, well, in Texas, we're going to put money into mental health.
Right. And so along those lines, if that were to come out, would it be more in the line of like a tenant-based rental assistance or in more of an operating nature or...
It's designed in the budget anyway, as a rental assistance program, as a voucher.
Okay.
State funded. So where we thought it didn't have a chance, there's a lot of discussion from legislators, some at least, that they would love to fund something, just tell them what to fund for people with mental health issues, which doesn't get to everybody, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think that there's been discussions previously about the permanency of rental assistance in terms of the ability to underwrite that rental assistance into an affordable housing development. So, you know, I did see that exceptional item, and I think that it's very important. I think that it would function as our home TBRA functions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it wouldn't be that kind of project-based subsidy that I think that Cameron was mentioning had been utilized in North Carolina.
And from a from a permanency and underwriting perspective, is that sort of legal guidance that you're getting that it would be treated differently than some sort of federal rental assistance like $811 or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it would be part of the 14-15 biennium unless they changed statute in some way.
As my knowledge, that's about it as far as the current legislative session. Although I understand there's some other things working in the service side that might direct some housing. SB 7 has a housing piece in it that's getting filled in. Hopefully some recommendations from service and rent to housing. So there may be some things actually at the end of the day that come out of this session.
I mean, different states really took kind of tackled this challenge in different ways. Georgia, for example, really created a lot of incentives and actually, you know, spent some political capital really reaching down to local housing authorities to try to develop relationships to get some targeted project-based rental assistance, and then left it up to developers to kind of close the deal and bring projects in with either commitments or some type of preference for persons with disabilities or homeless.
Can I ask you a question about that, actually?
Sure.
So in partnering with the local public housing authorities to get targeted project-based rental assistance, was it that when there was a how exactly did they do that in terms of the limited resource that is Section 8? Because I'm just wondering about, you know, most, if not all, the public housing authorities in the state of Texas have lengthy waiting lists, some of which are closed and have not opened for years. And so I'm wondering, how did they get the PHAs to put that preference in, allocate a portion of their vouchers to project-based rental assistance?
As you know, Ashley, the Section 8 project-based voucher program is an optional program that every housing authority can project-base up to 20% of their vouchers. And not every housing authority does exercise that option. As part of the Section 8 project-based voucher regs, the housing authorities can elect to do that and can elect to do that for just to support general development or award it to existing multifamily rental projects or do it in a real targeted manner for supportive housing, which a number of housing authorities have explored and done nationally to spur permanent supportive housing development. The second kind of piece of it, once they actually make it a decision to actually target a pool of vouchers for project-based assistance, is really structuring their waiting list and preferences. They can do it a number of ways. They can draw folks directly from their general Section 8 waiting list, or they can elect to establish site-based waiting lists and specifically identify site-based preferences for each project-based award. That's typically how best it's been approached. The Section 8 PBV regs do allow for they do allow for a homeless preference, a preference generally for persons with disabilities, or a preference for people that are eligible for the services offered in conjunction with the housing. So really, that allows folks to match what services are offered with that housing with the individuals that are eligible to receive those services. That's really the rub, is to actually design it in a manner to really allow for a good referral network and targeting. Louisiana did that with their Section 8 project-based voucher allocation, a statewide allocation. Georgia is working on a local basis with a number of housing authorities to design their kind of structure and waiting list. In the report, you'll see that there were a number of places where that those are real, those are, you know, to be frank, ongoing challenges with local housing authorities. It really depends on how creative the housing authority and collaborative the housing authority is in terms of designing their preference. In addition, in terms of resources, like you say, Section 8 vouchers are fully utilized. It would have to be an initiative that a housing authority would look at implementing over time based on turnover. That said, larger housing authorities, because of their utilization and just the size of their portfolio, have more flexibility to implement a Section 8 project-based voucher program than, say, a smaller housing authority that has a 200-unit portfolio. They would have to do a very, you know, a small effort over time incrementally.
But there's a leadership pitch here that, you know, there's, like Jim said, some of these conversations are hard and take some time to develop. And I think it's got to be sold to the PHA if there's some benefit to them. And I think, you know, they're going to serve, you know, that person with a disability, for instance, may be on a waiting list anyway and may get housing at some point anyway. And, you know, the PHA could look at it as, well, you know, if they think about it through a project-based, you know, setup with a tax credit program or something, you know, those individuals who are going to be served may be more likely to get services through that mechanism than through just the normal approach, and they see it as a win-win. And, you know, when states, particularly the states who have some of these Olmstead issues, are going to the PHA, they're trying to sell it as a, you know, it's obviously a benefit to the state because they really need to create these housing opportunities for these specialized populations, but also for the PHAs as a win.
And there has been some work locally, primarily, I believe, with homeless coalitions around project-based voucher efforts in Texas, specifically, I believe, in Houston. And there's actually a current RFP with the San Antonio Housing Authority to implement a permanent supportive housing program using Section 8 project-based vouchers. So there's some some interest to move forward there. We just think that there's been some pockets of innovation and work in that area in Texas, and there's probably some room to grow that. One of the other pieces, the last piece in terms of the operating subsidy strategy, although it's not optimal from, say, a service provider's perspective or an advocate's perspective, is to get the rent, write the rent down to a 20% of AMI level or a 30% of AMI level over the 15-year compliance period. And that really is a cross subsidization strategy where and it has been done in a number of states, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, Louisiana has done some of that to really, as part of that, to write down the rents to a 20%, so the rents are set at $200 a month or whatever that 20% of AMI number is. That, you know, they're not going to be, they're not going to be an income-based affordability, so you may have places where folks are paying a little bit more than 30% of 30% of their income towards rent, but it does seem to match in a lot of different MSAs or areas of the state where they're not too rent burdened. HFAs that have kind of explored that strategy have done some testing and modeling of what percentage and what AMI percentage and what kind of main rental market, because it is a real function of different models of affordability, as well as what your rent structures are at the 60% of AMI level, and also what your operating costs are in terms of what level of 20% or 30% of AMI units could support. Like, for example, New Mexico really could, they took a look at some of the markets and really couldn't get their rents down to 20% of AMI. So they elected to for 30% of AMI for half of the set aside, and that the other half was going to be targeted at 50% of AMI. Certainly not optimal. Everyone in the state says it's not optimal, but they really they made up for that in other ways. They really tried to target the 50% of AMI units to folks with disabilities with a little bit more income, say disabled veterans or folks on SSDI. They also really try to create some referral mechanisms for folks that had a Section 8 voucher in marketing that those targeted units in that way. So it doesn't mean you can't go at it. You have to actually go at it in a different manner. So I wanted to just kind of describe the different kind of what states were doing with the from the internal subsidy approach. That didn't mean developers couldn't come to the table with Section 8 project basing. That was still encouraged. But that if they couldn't come up with Section 8 project base or some type of voucher or some type of rental assistance, then they had to get the points, they had to internally subsidize it themselves within their financing.
Well, I guess just a sort of a, you know, question coming back at you before we move on is, you know, if you know, we're going to put forward a report of recommendations to you, we want to consider what your thinking is and what works best in Texas. And so, you know, if the legislature, you know, got a report from the council about ways to provide, you know, to write down rents or, you know, utilize state-funded rental assistance, you know, what would be your wish list? What would be the recommended approach for you guys in terms of, you know, is it trying to get some sort of project-based funding or tenant-based funding that can go into projects, or trying to get some additional funding to write down rent through some sort of operating reserve? What would you guys recommend considering Texas?
We've tried the internal subsidies, haven't they? Isn't that?
Well, I mean, we do effectively what is internal subsidies now. I'm looking at our income targeting. We require, well, we incentivize, which functions as a threshold requirement because you won't win unless you do it. We incentivize, for example, in urban areas, 40% of your units would be at 50% or less, and on top of that, 10% of your units would be at 30% or less. And if you do supportive housing, you can get a couple additional points for doing an additional 20% of your units at 30%. So you end up with fairly deep. What enables us to do this is relatively high rents.
Yep.
In Texas, especially in places like Dallas, Austin, you know, Houston, and pretty strong economics in those areas. So we definitely do some of that internal, what do we call it, internal subsidy right now. I mean, really, at the end of the day, my perspective is what is necessary to really have an impact is ongoing project-based rental assistance. Just from a purely economic standpoint, these deals would really need that type of subsidy to really effectuate this service-enriched model.
But until such time as you've got a lot of project-based assistance spread diversely throughout your community, I think tenant-based assistance is a lot easier to manage under fair housing issues and analysis of impediments to choice and all of those.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with Tim. You know, tenant-based rental assistance is great in its flexibility. The great thing about project-based assistance is because it can be counted on, it facilitates new units. Tenant-based assistance generally does not facilitate new units. So if you're in areas where housing is older housing stock and there's not a whole lot of new stock around, or you might have accessibility issues and those types of things, tenant-based assistance is not going to get you the outcome that's desired, I don't think.
One of the interesting, in contrast to the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program, where the average federal subsidies in around the $700 to $800 level, depending on the municipality that administers it, the average kind of state contribution for rental assistance for the North Carolina model. The starting point was either 60% or 50% or could it even be matched up with some of those 30% units, was writing the unit down from the individual's income to the 30% level or the 50% level. So your average rental assistance was around the $220 per participant or per unit level, as opposed to $600-$700 for Section 8. So from an efficiency perspective, it was fairly efficient and not very costly. Why don't we move on to the last bullet point within financial strategies? I did want to bring it up because different states, not all states, have moved in this direction from a housing policy perspective and financing, but some states have used it, and it's not necessarily a supportive housing strategy, but it when it was used in states with supportive housing, it did really help with the glue and linkage and a backstop for property management to link folks up and keep folks engaged with their service provider. Was the ability for service coordinations to be funded within a low-income housing tax credit program. Particularly PHFA had a long, and Pennsylvania had a long tradition of using that model. And what they've seen that has actually helped kind of long-term tenancy across their portfolio in general, and really it's not necessarily providing case management services or service provision, it's actually linking folks up with community resources and supports so they can be successful and be successful tenants. And it's not necessarily folks that are disabled, it could be just families or elders. It kind of runs the gamut. Just wanted to kind of bring that up as a discussion point and something that we saw as an observation.
Was there a question in there, Jim?
I don't know if that was seen as attractive. I know it's sometimes HFAs have, you know, obviously a challenge with supporting that within their operating budgets, and not all HFAs have supported it. I just wanted to throw that out because it was seen as pretty important, at least within Pennsylvania.
And I guess maybe to shape a question in there, you know, on the services side of things, service providers, you know, are going to provide some, you know, the basic services and life skills and all that stuff. But there's also that part that's, you know, relates to connecting with other services and things that are important for the person to maintain their housing, and that's maybe a little bit more of a, almost more of a housing function, and that benefits the housing owner or property manager. And so I guess part of the question is, you know, is there a preference as to, you know, does that function stay with the service provider, or is that more of a function that's built in and paid for elsewhere because it's seen as a little bit more of a housing function and benefits the permanency of the individual, which ultimately benefits the property manager owner in that situation? Because I think in states play it differently, and some states, you know, their service providers can do a good job at it, but in other areas, maybe they don't do such a good job at that particular function. They really are good service providers, but they're not necessarily good at this particular function.
I go back to sort of the first bullet point about incentive versus requirement, and I think if your value structure leans towards incentives, as Cameron said, you want to do what attracts people who are really passionate about what they're doing. So, you know, I don't think you necessarily want to drive it one way or the other. I think you want to leave it to the developer and the provider working in concert to come up with something. And as far as we're concerned, the only issue is, does it underwrite?
Yep.
Yeah, I would, just a quick question. Do you know, I know some of the folks from Pennsylvania, does this operate out of the same area as the kind of application review and award for tax credit deals, or is this a completely different section of their department that does this type of function?
It's the Housing and Services Program is a completely different division. They work closely with the multifamily staff, and they're more aligned with asset management because they're kind of after the deal, although they're part of the project application review.
Gotcha. Okay.
Well, I was just going to say, I tend to believe the service coordination, and particularly in Texas right now, it seems like we have a lot of money for service coordination,
mm-hmm.
And very little for housing. So we're getting a lot of, through the Medicaid waiver funding and the BIP and the community choice and all the funding that's coming down that way, we seem to be putting a lot of housing navigators out there and
yep.
people in the community who now know, and I say this as I often do, but now they know how to spell housing, and they know that there's a system of housing out there. Unfortunately, there's still not affordable housing in their area. So we've got a lot of these navigators, because we've helped train some of them to understand the system that is housing, that is not the system of social service. Two very, very, very different things. And we usually have a lot of service advocates start talking housing, and they think they can go to the state and get everything. Because in the service, you go to the state or the federal government, and you get everything. Service-wise.
Do you know those navigators are sitting in provider agencies or state employees?
Right. So just to clarify a little bit of the background on that one, so with the Money Follows the Person demonstration administrative funding, there has been, through the Department of Aging and Disability Services, DADS has been able to apply for that money and implement it. It started with housing navigators in their aging and disability resource centers, but I believe it's spread since then. And another source of funding that Gene was mentioning, the BIP, that's the Balancing Incentives Program, which I know other
right.
states are also doing, but in Texas, it's something where the projects have been approved by CMS. They're just now starting to figure out the rollout of that, but it does mean that, I guess, in the pipeline, if you're looking towards the future, there is that funding that's going specifically towards that kind of resource specialists that are either employed within facilities helping persons exit
yeah.
institutions like state-supported living centers or state hospitals, trying to get that connection made then to the residential-based housing is what is being funded through the BIP.
Okay.
And I was also going to say, just in terms of the other options for financing service coordination, and I know that you guys have seen our Section 811 application, but one of the things that we put in our interagency partnership agreement was the agreement that our fellow state health and human service agency partners had identified in the local communities those locally based partners that could be those referral agents. So that is just the way that the application, interagency partnership agreement was written within the Section 811 application.
Yeah, and you guys seem comfortable with that model, it sounds like. How that's all come together between the navigators and you know, obviously you wrote into the 811 application.
Affordable might be a stretch. See how it works for you.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But the good point though is that there is some angst from the housing perspective that the quality of that linkage may fall short, which then makes the housing a little more precarious. Is that correct?
And more pressure on the property managers.
Yeah. Okay.
Moving on, I guess the last point in the financial strategies was just the public-private resource strategies. We touched upon a couple of areas where private philanthropy was used either for a planning function or an evaluation function or a troubleshooting function to kind of provide targeted technical assistance if, for example, Illinois, their system kind of got a little bit off track a little bit, and they the Chicago local trust stepped in to provide some support to get their system back on track a little bit and brought stakeholders together. Are there areas that may make some sense within Texas for private philanthropy to really play a role within either recommendations or a rollout of a strategy working with the state that you can foresee, or particular philanthropic organizations that may make some sense to partner or to engage early on?
We haven't been able to convince Michael Dell that housing's that important. He's been great about funding our technology initiative. Stuff is not engaged in housing. He could house a whole lot of people in his house here, but other than that, no. I don't put a lot in Texas in the philanthropy side.
There are pockets of it.
There are pockets.
You know, I think Houston Endowment has done a ton down in Houston.
That's true. Yeah, there are pockets in certain areas.
But it's mostly locally driven rather than state.
Yeah.
And, you know, for what it's worth, too, I mean, we're sort of thinking housing and bricks and mortar, but there may be opportunities when it comes to, like, workforce development in terms of, you know, putting some dollars forward to train up folks on, you know, the service coordination pieces or just the importance of in-home mobile service support, things like that, that, you know, maybe a Hogg Foundation could come to the table or something. I don't know if that's ever...
There were some developing initiatives down in Galveston. I know Mitchell, you know, those guys were looking at investing in tax credit housing.
You know, another kind of thing that this reminded me of was at one point the council did actually meet and speak with a national CDFI, the Disability Opportunity Forum, Disability Opportunity something. DOF fund, Disability Opportunity Fund, and you know, I've in trying to keep up with them, you know, because that was, you know, I think their model is a public-private partnership model, and I haven't heard a great deal on that front, but you know, CDFIs are obviously out there. I know that they pretty much do locally based work. There's not a whole lot of statewide work being done that I know of and by CDFIs.
I mean, just the cynic in me says that there are as many models as there are domain names.
I don't think we should put, I don't think a lot of our effort needs to go in this area.
Yeah, no, we recognize that it was part of the our mandate in terms of scope of work, so we did want to kind of bring it up with folks. As you probably see, we didn't spend too much time with the best practice report on it, but we did highlight some attractive areas.
Well, I'm sure that at some level there's some coordinated interface among major foundations and the like, and I would love it if they would convene some sort of colloquium to discuss coordination and support for this initiative.
I mean, that's an interesting, from a homeless perspective, that there is a collaboration of philanthropic organizations nationally involved in homelessness and ending homelessness. The Melville Charitable Trust plays a leadership role within it. The Gates Foundation's pretty strong in it. I mean, we could take a look at see if there's any Texas-based organizations.
But it might even be something that we can suggest to the Melville Trust, just because we have a strong relationship with them, to, you know, proactively, you know, reach out to other philanthropy in Texas to engage that conversation.
Well, I really do think the Houston Endowment's been kind of a leader in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because they did play that role in bringing a number of philanthropic organizations to Louisiana post-Katrina and trying to and create that leadership advocacy piece of bringing other funders down that may not necessarily have had a history in Louisiana because of the disaster. Moving on, the next area was the service-enriched, the housing models, just a general conversation about different states had different approaches. Some focused primarily, if not only, on integrated housing. Others historically focused on single-purpose housing, single-purpose supportive housing, and didn't necessarily until recently, were involved in, specifically Georgia, were involved in integrated housing. Others have over time, because of cost considerations and homestead considerations, community integration issues and challenges, and where their provider advocacy network has gone, have moved away from single-purpose housing, maybe not purely or completely, but have placed more state policy efforts on encouraging the integrated model. It'd be interesting kind of to hear kind of where Texas is at and kind of what some thoughts are around that that piece.
We have a big fight in the disability community on this.
Well,
I can tell you that.
Yeah. In terms of integrated models, you know, it can be a pretty difficult thing. You know, oftentimes we see supportive housing that and our incentives in the QAP are based on 100% supportive housing type transactions that do not carry debt. They have some very key objective elements that really attract only those mission-driven organizations, which allows us to incentivize it. When you get into more integrated type models, I think, you know, hopefully the rollout of some of this, the Section 811 program and that type of thing will help us kind of venture into this arena more. In the past, it's been more about, again, those same mission-driven organizations may set aside certain units in their transactions, like Foundation Communities and their M-Station project has, you know, 30-some-odd units of more supportive housing style. You know, there's case management services, et cetera, and an otherwise, you know, conventional tax credit development. But those get more difficult to create incentives for without some of the other elements that states have access to, such as rental assistance, state-based rental assistance. I guess we've seen both. We currently have an incentive for a more single-purpose model, and our equal opportunity when it comes to integrated models. There's no particular scoring advantage, but there's also no discouraging it of that type of housing either.
You know, it's one of those issues where it's the states really think through what's financially viable and all that stuff versus how things are being interpreted or enforced legally from an Olmstead perspective for people with disabilities on the disability side. And that's been when you look at like Georgia, for instance, their HFA was developing housing in one way, and once they got slammed with their DOJ lawsuit, they had a pretty big shift in their thinking because of how the deliverables were in the Olmstead settlement agreement, but just essentially how the ADA was being interpreted now. And so I think that's something, I think Gene probably hit it on the head in terms of, there's a debate in the disabilities community from somewhat of a policy perspective, and then there's how things are being enforced legally under Olmstead.
Yeah, and we have at the state level, at the agency level, we have a rule of integration, but which could totally be taken away if Senate Bill 7, which has in there more of a push, because there are advocates that want down home ranch and want places that are segregated. I mean, they're just for one particular population.
Yeah.
So we're having some issues. It's going to come to a head here this session for us anyway. So it'll be interesting to see how we come out.
Yeah.
We feel like HUD has made it pretty clear in their traditional 811, the last go round, integration for them was no more than 25% of a project. So they were at 10% for a while, now they're at 25%. We did the integration rule here based on the population of people that had disabilities. And we totally pulled it out of what the population was at that time, because there was no guidance.
Yeah, but it's also a good point from Cameron's perspective in terms of the level of state rental assistance or subsidy that can come into a project to make it work financially. And that's sort of, ultimately that's something for, that's internal to the state that you're going to have to grapple with. If you decide to move in a policy perspective or direction that's much more integrated housing, the reality of financing that comes into play. And, those two don't, can't necessarily be split.
Right. Well, and I think there's also an issue on the services side. We are definitely not the service experts. We require supportive services and those types of things. But from a monitoring perspective, it's an incredibly difficult venture. It's one of our areas with the most non-compliance issues. And it comes down to that's not our core expertise. With 811, I think we're developing a great partnership that will help facilitate more integrated style housing, as well as a more effective service delivery model. But the ongoing operating and rental assistance there is very limited in the amount of funding we're getting. And so as soon as that dries up, it's difficult to maintain that type of partnership without something to replace the ongoing operating support.
Also, I should say that, along the lines of what Gene was mentioning with, HUD setting their maximums for, set-asides that are specific and therefore setting kind of an integration perspective forward with their funding sources. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see in Texas if what comes out of this state legislative session with the bills that are currently underway is how it plays out in those conversations about if you take away the integrated model and you're trying to put in a single purpose model of the nature that they're talking about. Typically what that comes with, because it's a necessity for the population that you're targeting, is a higher level of services and acute services, and how that kind of housing model could be funded, given the fact that there are very strict rules and regulations on how, especially TDHCA funding, can be utilized in that something that requires ongoing nursing, medical, psychiatric care is not an eligible use of our tax credit dollars according to IRS code. So I'm just, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, in terms of integrated versus single purpose, you kind of have to also think about how acute the service need of those individuals living together would be, and then how you fund that. Because it's a tangled web.
Well, it is a tangled web, and before Jean leaves, I'd like to just say, when she said there's a significant controversy within the disability community, that is absolutely right. And,
yeah,
you know, there are things that it would be politically impossible for us even to tiptoe into those discussions, let alone facilitate or resolve them, but they are discussions that need to be had. I can tell you, as the parent of a young adult with autism who goes around and does things with a caregiver who also takes care of a young man who is blind, I can tell you they've got completely different needs and completely different horizons.
Yeah.
And, you know, and ultimately, you know, I think on the single service model, the model itself is part of the service. The physical model itself is part of the service. And I think we need to come to grips with that and frankly, begin down a road of some differentiation and understanding so that everybody's horizons can be as open as possible, but also as supportive as possible.
Okay.
I think we look at everything with Medicaid, as we talk about, it's a matter of choice. And if your only choice is to be in an institution because there's no services in the community,
right,
that's not a choice. So,
right.
I mean, I think a lot of people think some of us are very hardline. Well, we're really not. We're just hardline now because there is no choice. There is not choice.
Right.
So until there is choice,
yeah,
you know, which is where I think we all want to get to, but the conversations are I think everybody's struggling with them now.
Yeah, and some of it may be even, you know, where there may not be differences of opinion on, you know, depending on a person's level of needs, whether, you know, someone lives, you know, fully integrated into a building or in some shared setting. You know, some of it just then comes down to the size of the setting and what funding sources may be appropriate to fund the bricks and mortar piece of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, CMS is still holding up the rules on how you describe housing.
Qualified residents.
I mean, yeah. So everybody's afraid to put their card out there because it's going to burn up. We've got to get there so we can move on. And
my guess is on the CMS side of things that we'll see something by the end of the calendar year.
I hate to tell you this.
All right, 11.
You're at least at risk of losing your quorum on this end because Jane's got to go and Cameron and I have to go too.
Okay.
Well, I think the last piece, and maybe kind of just to simplify things, was around the housing coordination staffing models, and the different states dealt with it in different ways. Some of it in certain states, it primarily was out of the housing entity. Others, it was out of the service entity. Others had it regionally based. In others, it was just at the state or the state level and didn't have that breadth. And it really gets into the kind of notion of the this this development of your of the Texas model that you've started working on this past summer with the Section 811 application. You know, based on kind of taking a look at the different states, how folks are doing it, has that, would you take a look at your model a little differently? Would you tweak it in any way? Kind of moving forward with the 200 units within the Section 811 effort, but possibly using that platform to expand it further with some of these recommendations. How do you kind of look at moving forward? Who's going to manage the waiting list? Who's going to do the troubleshooting, housing coordination function of reaching down to the owner level to troubleshoot things if the referral network's not working, that type of thing.
I think, Jim, with you mentioned the 811 model, I think what really came into high relief while we were writing the application for that, when it comes down to these things like staffing and for referrals and for the waiting list, is that there's not a lot of dedicated funding that you can utilize. What ended up happening for us is realizing that the 5% of admin that goes along with Section 811 had to be supplemented because it really wasn't enough. Thankfully there was that resource available at this time through DADS, Department of Aging and Disability Services, to provide some staffing. I think that was a really big concern that I heard from other states as well when we had a debriefing on the Section 811 NOFA is how do you pay for specifically these tasks?
Yeah. So it sounds like from your perspective, you're going to kind of move forward cautiously in terms of the structure, in terms of the responsibilities, and see how it goes and kind of make adjustments as you go along.
Yeah. it is called a demonstration program, and we are trying something very new for the state of Texas, and we're very excited about it, but we would love, we're very interested to see how other states as well that have been awarded this funding, whether or not that they've done something like this before, how they also move forward with the demonstration funds.
Yeah, and I think as we had said yesterday on the call, actually, the prep call, some of the TA that's going to come out of HUD will bring states together and give states the opportunity to really kind of learn from each other. So.
Great. I didn't want to end this without, opening the floor completely to say if there's anybody here, anyone on the call that had any burning items that they wanted to bring to this committee's call and say, say to TAC and let TAC know that we haven't already hit on. Wanted to open that up at the very end just to make sure we've covered your item. Okay.
Great. Thank you.
All righty.
All right. Thanks so much, Kevin and Jim. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.